Boydco, I don't see here. Mr. Delaney, why don't you come up, please? Mr. Hendricks, before we get started, on behalf of the committee, I really want to thank you for your hard work on this. You have done yeoman's work. We're already up to the dash. We were at dash 9 yesterday. We're at dash 14 today. I mean, that's just amazing. Thank you very much for your hard work. Maybe you could explain what the hell you've been doing for the last...
Chair Corcoran, members of the committee, Dave Hendricks, Senior Deputy Legislative Counsel. Unfortunately, I did this all so quickly, I can't remember what's in these amendments. No, I think I can tell you. A14...
We always suspected that, Mr. Hendricks.
A14 is the what I believe to be the final set. There are no A15s that I'm aware of. So the A14 is what you should be looking at. And the bill makes several technical changes to 2003 and a couple of more substantive changes as well. Probably the most significant starts out on lines 4 to 6 of the A14 amendment. We'll delay two of the pieces of the bill until January 1st, 2004, instead of July 1st, 2003, as it appeared in the Angros version of the bill. And the pieces that are delayed are the shifting of the 6%, the elimination of the 6% employee contribution, which was originally scheduled for July 1st, 2003. That will happen under these amendments on January 1st, 2004. Consistent with that change, the transition accounts, the accounts that were set up to take a 6% contribution in lieu of the employee contribution to PERS, it does not become operative until January 1st, 2004. So that piece of the bill is moved back 6 months. The rest of the bill goes into effect, though, on July 1st, including the provisions relating to crediting of amounts to Tier 1 members. The COLA provision is effective immediately. The requirement that the employer contribution rates be readjusted goes into effect on July 1st, 2003. All of the rest of the bill has a July 1st, 2003 operative date. The amendments that are done to Section 5 that starts on page 1, line 8, are primarily aimed at the crediting provisions with respect to Tier 1 members. And the principal two things that are going on here is, one is that there was a technical clarification that this crediting is also for alternate payees of Tier 1 members. That's always been the case under this, but there's some language that makes it very clear that that's the case. The bill retains the elimination of the five-year call. I mean, the amendments don't change the bill's current provisions, which eliminates the five-year call, as you can see on lines 18 through 20. That language is still bracketed out, so the five-year call goes away and continues to go away. On page 2, the other significant change on the crediting on Tier 1, starting at lines 1 through line 5, there's a clear statement now made in the statute that the only thing that is used to pay off the deficit that the system currently has by reason of the payment, the guarantee of payment crediting, the assumed interest rate, that only earnings on Tier 1, regular accounts of Tier 1 members is used to pay that off. So that means Tier 2 members' earnings are not used, nor are earnings on employer contributions. Moving on to page 3, We did some amendments to Section 10, which is the cost of living provision in the bill. I'm going to have to remember here exactly what we did. I think the only change we really made in Section 10 that's of terrible significance is we have adjusted the dates of retirement for those people who are affected by the cost of living pause, the one that, you know, this is the section that says the cost of living adjustments won't be paid for a given period of time, basically to offset the 1999 crediting that was made. 20% was issued. This section says 11.33 was what should have been credited, and until basically you get to where you would have been at as a retiree, if you had been credited with 11.33 in 1999, we're not going to give you cost of living adjustments. PERS, in looking at the dates we had in the Andros version, which had originally indicated that it would be February 1st, 2000 to February 1st, 2004, went back, thought about it again, and decided really it should be April 1st, 2000, April 1st, 2004, to really catch the universe of folks who would benefit from the 1999 crediting. And I think that's the only significant changes that we have in Section 10 that we really need to talk about. Other changes appear at the bottom of page 4, lines 29 through 30, and then going on to the next page on the transition account program. These were technical changes that the Treasury had requested. The Treasury wanted to make it clear how exactly these funds were to be invested. These are the accounts that are set up to take the 6% contribution that will be made in lieu of the employee contribution to PERS. On page 5 at line 6.
Before you go on, I want to especially thank the Treasury Department for coming in this morning with those changes.
At line 16 on page 5, we've set them up with a separate transition account fund that will be the recipient for the monies that are coming in, the 6%, and basically directs them, the Treasury, to invest these monies in that they may be, or it doesn't direct them, it says they may be invested in the same manner as the assets of the Public Employees Retirement Fund. That was an important piece because should the bill have problems in the courts, it would be best that monies that are in this transition account, these transition accounts, be invested in the same way to avoid the problems. If they were invested differently, of going back and figuring out how to put things back, how to unscramble the omelet. As long as they're invested in the same manner, that will be very helpful because the earnings will be the same as if they had been deposited in the fund with the rest of the monies currently in the Public Employees Retirement Fund. The other thing they requested starts at line 28, section 35A. All that does is amend the Oregon Investment Council Statute 293-701 to make it clear that these monies in these transition accounts are to be are within the authority of the OIC for investment, the same as PERS. On page 7, starting at line 14, we have a couple of tweaks to the language on the direct Supreme Court review of the provisions of the Act. As it came to you, 2003A had exclusive jurisdiction. This removes the exclusive jurisdiction. It also incorporates the language, essentially the language we had in 2004 on mortality tables about what types of claims can be brought to limit it basically to contract breach claims and to constitutional claims about the Act. On line 22, we have added a little language about standing that's slightly different than what's in the bill, but probably what everybody anticipated to be the case, which to make it clear that not only someone who is adversely affected when they file the case, but who will be adversely affected has standing to file a petition. That is particularly important because of shifting the changes on the 6% contribution back to January, since the petition has to be filed within 60 days of July 1st, 2003, and nobody will have lost any of their crediting on July 1st. It won't happen until January 1st of next year. So this is to say, look, if you're going to be affected by this, you have standing to bring the claim.
Mr. Hendricks. On page 7, line 18, I just want to be clear. I realize we're removing exclusive jurisdiction, but with the language that says whether the provisions of this Act breach any contract between the system and the employers or violating constitutional provisions, including but not limited to impairment of contract rights. It would seem to indicate, but not limited. Is that what is the intent of that?
The intent there, Chair Corcoran, is that when we indicate that they can bring a petition to determine whether or not the Act violates any constitutional provision, that it's any constitutional provision. You can make any constitutional argument you want. One of them may be impairment under Section 1, Article 1 of the Oregon Constitution, but that's not the only one you can bring.
Okay, thank you.
One of the other important changes that these amendments make starts at the bottom of page 7, where we amend one of the provisions of House Bill 2004. House Bill 2004, the bill that addressed mortality tables, as you remember, had this look-back provision. And the look-back provision was designed basically to smooth out to some degree the impact of the implementation of the new mortality tables on people who retire in the next few years. In essence, your account, your benefit was going to go flat for some period of time until you had more or less worn off the impact of the changes in the mortality tables. The way that look-back provision was designed, it was entirely keyed to the account balance of the member. How much did they have in their account balance on June 30th of 2003? And you looked at that, and the thing that caused the wear away was going to be the growth in the account balance, the payment of the additional contributions going in, the 8% growth because of the assumed interest rate. That was what was going to make the old mortality tables go away for the purposes of members who retired down the line. One of the impacts of 2003 is the account balance for many members won't make much difference if you stay in long enough. For no Tier 1 members won't make any difference, in which case we lost the wear away in effect because of the interaction of 2003 and 2004. The solution that was come up with is an amendment to that wear away provision, and the crucial language appears on page 8 at lines 14 through 20. What these amendments do is go back to that look-back provision and say, we're not going to just look at your account balance. We're going to look at two additional factors. We're going to look at how many years of service you had on June 30th, 2003, and we're going to look at your final average salary as of June 30th, 2003. Those are two of the components of the full formula calculation. By looking at those, you have provided a new engine, basically, for the look-back for everybody who retires under the full formula, and that will become more and more people. there will be a wear-away, and the wear-away will be determined by growth in final average salary and by increasing numbers of years of service for those people. The longer they work, the larger their full formula calculation will be, and it will gradually wear away the impact of the changes in the mortality tables. That's complicated. It was complicated to start with. It's hard to visualize this wear away on the mortality tables, but it was very clear there was a problem with the interaction between the two bills. That wear away was entirely hinged on account growth balance, and we've taken away account growth balance increases. So something needed to be done. And that pretty much sums up the amendment. I'd be happy to try to answer any questions.
Questions.
Senator Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Hendricks, and I too want to applaud you for all your work. I know this isn't easy. You're familiar with the letter that the chair sent to the Legislative Council on March 11th asking three questions?
Senator Corcoran, Senator Walker, yes.
Okay. And so you're probably familiar with the answers to those questions. And I just wanted to ask you, Legislative Counsel Greg Chamoff indicated that what we were doing here was a problem. And are any of the provisions in these amendments addressing the concerns raised by Mr. Chamoff in his responses?
Chair Corcoran, Senator Walker, no. These amendments are not addressed to those issues.
Thank you.
Everybody else fine? Okay, thank you very much. Mr. Boyko, you want to step up too? I told the Secretary of the Senate that I would try to have the paperwork to her by 3:30, so could you gentlemen keep that in mind? Thank you.
Chair Corcoran, members of the committee, we'll keep that in mind. There are four things that we did want to bring to the committee's attention, and it is more in the way of garnering from the committee legislative intent in terms of how we should implement the legislation that you're currently considering. Of the four items, I'll deal with the first one. My colleague, Mr. Delaney, will deal with the second two, and then I'll deal with the fourth one. The first one relates to a conflict between this legislation and an existing board rule. The rule basically says that what we do to Tier 1 member accounts, we do in crediting earnings to Tier 1-related employer reserves as well. I just want to get on the record that my understanding that since the intent of this legislation is to focus specifically on the Tier 1 members account, we've heard nothing in the House deliberations on this bill, nor the Senate, that indicates that the focus is on anything other than the members' account, that based on that process and our reading of the bill, we would go back to the board and recommend that this rule be done away with and replaced with a rule that is consistent with what our best understanding is the intent of this legislation. And this means that the provisions in 2003 that require us to do specific things to members' accounts, I'm particularly referring to the zero crediting aspect of 2003, would be specifically to member accounts and not to other accounts in the system. That's the first item. Mr. Delaney can deal with the next two, and then I'll finish with the last one.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Steve Delaney, PERS Legislative Liaison. The next two are just to explain how we'd be administering some technical issues of the bill. Section 8, dealing with the minimum account balance, this is the one that promises the lifetime 8% guarantee to member accounts. It says, well, if after a series of years of 0% earnings, PERS has to go back and make sure that the person got at least the assumed rate, currently 8%, over their career. If we were to actually encounter a year where the minimum account balance was higher than what the member's actual account was, where would we get those dollars? Our expectation would be that we would go to gross current year PERS fund earnings, if any, and pull them to pay that guarantee. On Section 10, this has to do with the COLA. We just wanted to explain what we would be doing with regard to COLAs for those members that retire and remain in the variable account. The COLA freeze applies only to the regular account. We would continue to pay a COLA to the variable portion of a member's account, but we wanted the committee to be aware that because of system limitations, we may actually have to freeze a person's account, and it may take us some months to manually calculate what that partial COLA just on the variable would be. We would then catch up the member's account at that point and pay a retro check. We just wanted the committee to understand how we would be approaching that.
Okay, thank you.
And Chair Corker and members of the committee, on the last issue relates to the transition accounts. We are understanding here that this is to be, and I think Treasury is on the same thinking, that this is to be a trust account, like the other trusts that PERS has fiduciary obligations toward. It's under 401A, which is the normal pension statute that allows us to get federal tax qualification. And I think that was mentioned earlier that the investment of those funds be under OIC and that they be flexible so that we can make sure, particularly given the uncertainty that faces the legislation, that we don't get ourselves in a position where we've invested them inappropriately and then have to unwind it. So the more flexibility you can give us, the better, and I believe that this language does that. However, there is one term in the statute, and that is that Section 13, Sub 5, directs the board to cease investments of the amounts in these accounts under certain circumstances. I believe this is a mechanism that is applicable to DB and money match type paradigms, but it doesn't really apply to a DC based trust.
Cease crediting.
Typically, in a DC fund, you continue to let the funds be invested and they earn what they earn. There's no exposure or harm to the fiduciaries or employers by letting that happen. Usually, DC accounts instead require a minimum distribution age or amount, similar to the distribution requirements for an individual retirement account, an IRA under federal law, or under our 457 deferred compensation program. So rather than ceasing investment, which would require us to put these funds in limbo and would potentially harm the member whose funds we were holding, we would rather that the at some point either you authorize the board or take it into your own hands to indicate a distribution requirement if that's your pleasure.
Well, can't the board take action themselves on that?
I believe so, Chair Corcoran, that if the legislation is silent about it, that it would be very likely that we, the staff, would recommend to our new board that there be a distribution requirement, and it would be usually at the normal retirement age that they would receive the remainder of their regular PERS benefits. So we would try to make the two coincide. If that's the committee's intent, then that's what we'll take back with us.
Yes, and I guess, to the extent that you can produce some direction or advice to the board on that and share that with us so that we can make it part of the record, that would be very helpful.
Thank you.
Okay, any questions? Seeing none, Senator Minnis.
Mr. Chairman, I move the adoption of the Dash 14 amendments to House Bill 2003.
Senator Minnis moves adoption of the Dash 14 amendments to House Bill 2004. Any discussion?
I won't be supporting those.
You won't be supporting those?
I will not.
Okay, thank you very much. Why don't you go ahead and call the roll, Ms. Gravel?
Senator Starr?
Aye.
Senator Walker?
No.
Vice Chair Minnis?
Aye.
Chair Colfer?
Aye. Amendments carry. Senator
Mr.
Minnis.
Move House Bill 2003 as amended to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Minnis moves House Bill 2003 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion?
Yes.
Senator Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate what we've been trying to do here, but I'm going to be a no vote on this bill. I think we were dancing dangerously close to the edge with House Bill 2004. I supported that. I think we're going over the cliff with 2003, and I frankly think it's unconscionable that we're voting on a bill without the AG's opinion, which was supposed to be due out today, and I understand we're not getting until next week. I tend to think there's something nefarious about that. But be that as it may, we have a legislative council opinion in response to three questions you posed, and that opinion makes it very clear that what we're doing here is what I would call, in response to what Mr. Gary called yesterday, unlawful also what we are doing here and did in 2004 is costing a significant amount of money in other funds expenditures. We've saved quite a bit in 2001 and 2004, and I think the responsibility for revenue shortfalls we have in our state and our budget condition shouldn't rest on the backs of our employees. So I'm sorry, but I'll have to be a no.
Thank you. I think the only thing I would do is take exception with your comment that this is on the backs of the employees. The financial crisis that we're in is one that we're going to confront here as we get this off the table and move to the question of services and revenues and appropriate budgets. And I'm not tying those two things together, so you can if you want, I suppose, but I think that that is part of the problem that's existed with this in terms of explaining to people what the level of crisis was and what the response was. That's just my two cents.
Well,
Ms. Gravel, go ahead.
Mr. Chair, I would just respond that my husband and I are counting on a specific retirement from his job. I'm self-employed. I don't really have much. And it's not much. It's pretty bad, actually. His employer's got a very bad retirement plan, but we're counting on that. And if that had been pulled out from under us, I'm not sure where we'd be now that he's in his 50s and I'm in my soon-to-be late 40s. So I think we're taking something away from people that had been guaranteed to them, and I just find that troubling.
Chairman.
Senator.
I just wanted to thank you for, I think, what I consider to be a very high level of integrity in dealing with this issue. It's very complex, and I know that you particularly have had a lot of pressure on you regarding this issue, but I do think, and I disagree with Senator Walker, I think for the most part, the only way we're actually going to get any certainty to the problem that clearly exists is by submitting our wisdom to the courts, and I think the courts will have to speak in. I think it's been clear from the very outset that that's going to be the case. And I think, as we've said, and I said in carrying House Bill 2003, that we're really praying to the courts to give us some guidance in this area, because clearly there are extremely difficult and complex questions that must be answered. We're not attorneys. We represent the people of the state of Oregon, the people's interests, and we try to do it with to the best of our abilities within the constraints of our intellect and our capacity to do so, and the counsel that we have. So to me, it's a very complex question. It's something that if anybody denies that there's a problem, I think they're fooling themselves. And again, I just want to thank you for your integrity in this issue, and I appreciate your hard work on this.
Thank you.
I would like to echo those comments in thanking you, Mr. Chair. You're in a tight position, I know that.
Thank you. Well, I want to compliment the entire committee. This, I've really been striving for transparency in this, because this was one we couldn't screw around with, so I think everybody did a good job. Would you call the roll, please?
Senator Starr?
Aye.
Senator Walker?
No.
Vice Chairman Minnick?
Aye.
Chair Corcoran?
Aye. So Senate Bill 2003 as amended to the floor with a due pass. Do you want to carry it together? Okay. Senator Minnick's not here. Thank you very much. We're adjourned.